If you're hearing this, welcome to Real Talk, not the evening news. It's just a father and his sons talking life, family, politics, and anything else the world throws our way. No scripts, no filters, just honest conversation. The kind families used to have around the kitchen table before everybody started arguing online. Pull up a chair and join the conversation. This is the ETC Podcast.
Welcome to the ETC Podcast. This episode is recorded on November 19th, 2025. And joining me today is the captain of the seas, the man heading to the ABC Islands, then to Jamaica, and then wherever else he's heading in the world.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was a crazy introduction. Thanks, Ryan. This is Tom. I am here in sunny South Beach. Not quite sunny, but it was very sunny today. South Beach in Miami, Florida.
And also joining me, Ben Shapiro's right-hand man, the ship repair of the seas, my brother and lovely co-host.
Yeah, I'm Chase. Definitely no one's right-hand man, but I do like Ben Shapiro.
I believe we're going to start out with one of the first topics today as we have our traveler with us today. Mr. Tom is live in Miami. Don't know the hotel. Probably not going to give that away, but he wanted to bring up the new Pittsburgh curbside terminal. Tell us all about it, Tom.
Yeah. So yesterday, the 18th, was the very first day for the new curbside terminal there at Pittsburgh International Airport. If you have traveled in and out of Pittsburgh over the past several years, you'll notice that the curbside terminal was starting to show quite a bit of age. It was set up for a very large hub that Pittsburgh used to be back in the day with U.S. Airways. Of course, with the acquisition of U.S. Airways and American Airlines coming together, that hub was moved away from Pittsburgh. So the flights from in and out of Pittsburgh went from like 300 a day down to 100 flights a day. Is still a pretty busy airport as far as commercial flights go. But they needed to do something and modernize that experience. So they did. They spent well over $1 billion and they built a wonderful and very beautiful new curbside terminal. So when you come in from parking, or through your shuttle or whatever at the Pittsburgh airport, you immediately walk into the new terminal. You'll go to the check-in stand for your airline, drop any bags that you have, walk immediately into TSA. The TSA line is, there's lots of stations, lots of equipment there. So there's multiple places that you can go through lines to make the process very quickly. We travel relatively frequently, so we have TSA pre-checked. We were through security in about 5 minutes. Instead of having to take the train from the curbside terminal to the airside terminal that you had to do prior to now, it's just a short little walkway, tunnel that you walk right through, and you arrive at the new, it's actually not new because the airside terminal is the same, and it hopefully will get remodeled eventually. But as of right now, the curbside terminal is new. It's beautiful. It's multiple layers or levels. And the whole process today was absolutely fantastic. We use a service called Fast Park. It's an off parking or off airport parking service. We go actually park at that location. It's quite a few dollars cheaper per day than parking at the airport. They literally send a shuttle right over to your car, pick you right up, load your bags for you, drop you right at the door. And then when you come back, basically they load you right into the shuttle, take you right to your car, help you unload and load into your car, and you're good to go. It's just a couple minutes outside of the airport there in Pittsburgh, and we use that. So we left our hotel right around 3:30, 4 o'clock this morning, got to the airport probably a few minutes after 4, probably about 4:30-ish, give or take a little bit, 4:15-ish. I went through security, and we were sitting in the lounge when it opened at 4:30 a.m., and our flight boarded about 5:20. We left Pittsburgh a couple minutes after 6, and arrived here in Miami, and we're in our hotel before 10 a.m. this morning. So it's been a relatively uneventful day, but a fun day nonetheless, and great time there in Pittsburgh.
No, absolutely. That does sound like a wonderful time. So you guys heard it here first. If anything happened in Pittsburgh from the time of 3 to 4:30 in the morning, Tom has an alibi. He was not there. He does not know what happened. He was very logistical in what happened. So one thing I wanted to ask you, because you've traveled a lot more inside and out of Pittsburgh through air than I have. I've driven through Pittsburgh, but I've never flown out of Pittsburgh. Does this new opening help travelers, or is this as same as the old one?
Well, I think ultimately it's going to help on the capacity side. The TSA lines at the old terminal were smaller areas, so they couldn't funnel as many passengers through them at the same time. So that made a kind of a bottleneck. And then you had the train. So that was a little bit of a bottleneck as well, because typically both sides weren't running at any given time. So you had to wait on the train. It was only a 2-minute train ride over to the other, to the airside terminal. But still, it's much more efficient. It's faster. You know, there's tons of restrooms. That was something I noticed. You know, previously there was very few restrooms on the land side. So you had to get through security, ride over to the airside terminal to even get to the restrooms. So much nicer, much more efficient. It should help travelers, especially as we're getting ready to enter the busiest travel season of the year with Christmas and the holidays coming.
Sounds like you got it down. I mean, this is coming from the guy that on almost every trip I've been on with him always has about 3 to 4 backup plans for anything that could possibly get wrong. So, yeah, it's just the travel agent. It's always funny to hear about all his backup plans, even if everything goes smoothly.
Yeah, it's been fun. It's always fun to travel. I enjoy flying out of Pittsburgh. You got a lot more options than you do flying out of Charleston or Morgantown or some of the other airports there in West Virginia. So it's nice. And Pittsburgh's only 90 minutes away from our house there in Morgantown.
Yeah, I could see how that would be an advantage.
Yeah. So, you know, back last week or so, there's a big story that came out of Miami here where the 18-year-old young lady was found dead in her room on the Carnival Horizon, and she passed away at sea. There's some news that came today looking at her stepbrother, which I believe he is 16 years old. Apparently, he potentially may be a suspect in the murder investigation. So a couple of things that I cruise a lot. We've done, I don't know, several dozen cruises in our life so far. I want to talk a little bit about safety. You know, it's a resort. It's a resort in the middle of the ocean. So the big differences there is you're with the same people all week, number one, or for the term of your cruise, whether it be a 3-day cruise or a 13-day cruise or anywhere in between or even longer. You're with the same people during that entire time. Second of which is it's a closed environment. So there's not people coming and going like you would have in a resort, like if you go to Cancun and stay at a 5-star beachfront resort in Cancun and all-inclusive or whatever. You know, people can come and go from the community or from the area. So it's not a closed environment. But like anywhere that you're out in public or with, you know, even in our own community, we need to be situationally aware of what's going on. This particular incident looks like who knows what the motive was or who knows what the thought process was. If this turns out that this young man was the person that murdered his stepsister. And if it turns out to be that is the case, you know, what was going through his head? I mean, this was that would be an isolated event and not something that the average person failing would encounter. But back to situational awareness, and that's really what I aim to do, because I'm about to go take a 10-day cruise to the Caribbean. And you've got to be situationally aware. Just like you would be walking down the street here in Miami, you need to know what's around you, who's around you, pay attention to that. Don't be looking at your phone or your device. Look around your surroundings, who's around you, who's following you, anybody, you know, you see anybody with weapons, anything that looks suspicious, that sort of thing. I mean, you just got to keep your eyes open and listen and use your senses to determine a potential threat or potential situation that you may want to get yourself out of really quickly. And that's really what I'm thinking. Bringing this up, I want to make sure that people are very situationally aware. It's one of the things kind of difficult for me. I'm a concealed carry holder in West Virginia. I have a concealed carry permit. I carry everywhere legally that I can carry. Now, Florida is an area where I could carry. However, in the cruise ship, there's no means to store that firearm while I'm on the cruise. So there's not an easy way for me to have my concealed weapon here while I'm here in Florida with me and be able to secure it while I'm on the cruise and then get it when I'm back in the U.S. and so forth and so on. So it makes it a little more difficult in this situation to conceal carry. Not conceal carrying, my senses are a little heightened. I'm paying attention to my surroundings. I'm trying not to get myself into places that are a bit sketch. You know, it's dark here. It's been dark here for a little over an hour. I want to make sure that we're just aware of our surroundings as we're walking down the street to go eat dinner tonight or anything like that. And probably the second one is, first off, anyone else want to add to that conversation on situational awareness?
I mean, situational awareness is also a big thing, but also being a father of a daughter, you know, and my daughter, she's young, but you do recognize, in my opinion, women nowadays, I think sadly, do need to have more situational awareness, because I think that a lot of men out there just are untrustworthy or naturally weird. And now there is one thing I wanted to bring up when it comes to this cruise ship or the murder that taken place. And this death of Anna Kepler, it is very tragic. And I do hope that whoever did the crime does pay the time. I hope that that happens. It is pretty much, though, from what I've heard, you know, going back to the missing case of Amy Lynn Bradley on a cruise ship. I mean, this was a 23-year-old in 1998 who disappeared off a Royal Caribbean ship, Raspy of the Seas. Any true crime person or somebody who watches it on Netflix knows the case of Amy Lynn Bradley because of how crazy that was. The last confirmed sighting of Amy Lynn Bradley was around 5 in the morning. Her dad saw her asleep on the balcony attached to their cabin. When he checked again around 45 minutes later, she was gone. Her shoes were still in the room and there was no sign of a struggle. To this day, they still don't know what happened to her, and that was 1998. Yes, like, I think a logistical nightmare when it comes to cruise ships or murders would be, and you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, Tom, because the amount of cruise stuff I know is only through true crime. But the biggest nightmare, I think, when it comes to cruise ships is going to be the maritime or whoever owns that boat, right? Because for tax purposes, or cruise ships, because for tax purposes, a lot of these boats are registered in Panama, the Bahamas, Liberia, yep. Malta. You know, these boats, they are owned by different countries. So they don't necessarily, unless a United States citizen is harmed and you're a United States port, that's when the United States can kind of flex its guns. And am I right with that? Like, for example, as the crime commits in middle of sea water, like we'll have it with Amy Lynn Bradley, they have to wait until they get to a port before the United States, FBI, anybody can investigate outside of cruise ship security.
So, okay, so if it's a U.S. citizen and it occurs in international waters on a ship that sailed out or started out of the U.S., then the FBI would have jurisdiction in that environment. And that's who's investigating this recent incident, is the FBI. I'll tell you, the cruise ship has top-notch security. All the major cruise lines have top-notch security. There's cameras everywhere on those ships. They can track your movement. They know what you're doing. Some particular cruise lines even have RFID tags that you use for your doors and to get from places to place. And, you know, those also kind of track you within the ship itself. So there's a lot of evidence that could be collected, but they're very efficient. being able to document that type of thing and secure the environment and handle it. But keep in mind, I mean, some of these cruise ships have 6,000 guests on them every week. So you think about that. So just out of Port of Miami, tomorrow, there's 6 cruise ships leaving. You know, the biggest one probably has 4,500 people. The smallest one probably has 2,500 people. So think of how many thousands of people are leaving Port of Miami every single day. 7 days a week, there are cruise ships in and out. That's actually a relatively light day for the port. So, you know, when you consider the number of people that sail every single day and you look at the crime statistics, cruise ships are a very safe way or mode of travel. You hear about these incidents, but they're very isolated. And there is that logistical nightmare around jurisdiction and things like that. But it's something that has been worked out and is handled very efficiently between the cruise lines and the FBI and any authorities from any other countries as well. So it's kind of handled and taken care of pretty well. I would say between the early 90s and or late 90s to today, that process has even got a lot better because technology has gotten a whole lot better.
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly agree to that, that with anything where it comes to crime, technology has gotten a lot better. And we were talking about that the other day, that it's just, it's harder for kind of people to get away with things, especially when it comes to violent crimes. I was just going to kind of point out that out of the cruise that I've been on, and I think of two at this point, I never really felt unsafe. I mean, it was like the entire time there was almost nowhere that you were going alone. I mean, it's probably only in a couple places that you would ever actually end up going somewhere where there wasn't, you know, other people at. So for instance, maybe if you were out really late on the boat and maybe walking the pier or something, and I don't even know if that stays open the whole time, but maybe then you might end up being alone or with like one or two other people. But for the most part, everything's public, and I feel like it's just one of those things that it would be hard to really for someone who a bad actor, as they say, to try to get away with something because there's just so many eyes kind of everywhere.
Yeah, definitely. And you just never know. Your cabin's about the only place that you're not going to be on camera, you know, within the cabin itself or in the bathrooms. Every place else, I mean, it's pretty much free reign, and there are cameras everywhere. I mean, if you're out on the balcony, there's cameras that can see you in your balcony that overhang the side of the ship. That most of those are infrared cameras and heat sensing cameras, which are used to ensure that no one goes overboard and all of that type of thing. But the technology is just pretty amazing. We love to cruise. We'll continue to cruise. And we've got one scheduled for January after we get back from this one. So we're back at it again in a very short time frame.
We're going to take a quick dinner break and talk about our website. Visit us at etcpodcast.com. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. So swing by our site or tune in on your favorite platform. And while you're there, leave us a 5-star rating or you're not invited to dinner. Or pull up a chair and add your voice to the table. Tell us what's on your mind for this or any other episode. All right. Plates are empty, table's clean, dishes are done. Let's get back into the conversation.
Other topic that I want to bring up, and I kind of intentionally didn't give the guys the topic because I kind of wanted first impressions. I took literally 5 minutes before this show and hopped on the internet and went to a couple of news websites and kind of looked at the top stories and what was going on and went to Newsmax.com. And there's a top story there that requires that Texas public schools have the Ten Commandments somewhere within the school. I don't know the specific law or what the requirements are specifically, but let's kind of talk about that. I'll let both of you guys chime in first and kind of give me your opinion, what your thoughts on that, and then I'll kind of wrap it back up. And then that's the second topic that I had for tomorrow.
Yeah, I'll go on and take the first one. And this is, as always, we talk about this is a family conversation, just like all three of us sitting around the dinner table. And naturally, we're going to have different opinions about the topics. So in my honest opinion, when it comes to this, I don't think that every single kid, if you're not in this religion, should have the Ten Commandments. I think it's definitely fine to have in school. Now, I'm saying all this without knowing the case. I don't know the city. I don't know what was being done with the Ten Commandments. For example, when we were kids in 2005 or whatever, you stood up, you said your Pledge of Allegiance, and sometimes you had a prayer and that was it. But I cannot speak on how it was in class. You know, for example, if they were standing up every single morning and saying the Ten Commandments, then yeah, I'm against it. But this is also coming from someone who is not as deep in Christianity as what I used to be. Me and my kids, my wife, we go to church, but I'm not where I used to be. So I'm still learning where I am in my pathways of faith, but the way I see it is, as long as it wasn't getting shoved down every single kid's throat, that to me, it could have stayed in the school just fine. I mean, for example, and I'm going to butcher this because I'm terrible with other religions, I'm not even great at my own, the headgear that other religions wear, you know? Yeah, like yarmulkes and everything else. You know, if those can be in school, I think the Ten Commandments should be too. But that's just my opinion. I'm going to let my brother take it over and see if he's got a different take that maybe he agrees with, maybe I disagree with. We'll see what happens.
I mean, something like this, for me, tends to make me think that the Ten Commandments being up at the school on a statue or whatever it was, I think it just kind of, it's something points towards our history and our culture, Western civilization, especially America. And I don't think it's far-fetched to say founded on Christian ideals, and it was the predominant religion, still is the predominant religion in this country. So, it's one of those things that it comes with being in America, and I don't think Texas is going to be a far cry from that. Now, it is a very difficult topic, I agree, because, you know, if we're going to feel like that's okay for these, you know, the Ten Commandments to be there, or, you know, things pointing towards historically Christian values, then what would we have to say about other religions having, for instance, in cities, which could even be in America, that is populated more by the people who practice other faiths and religions? Does it then offend us if there were to be statues or things at schools representing their religion? And that can be a difficult topic, and it depends on how exactly it came about for these statues or things pointing to other religions to be at other schools. I think that's important as far as how it gets there. Is it just kind of crammed down everyone's throat regardless of how you feel? Or is it going to be something that historically has been? And I think that's where you have to draw the line of when you're taking things down that have historically been there and are a part of the culture, it kind of becomes a big difference in putting new things up, especially if it may not be in line with the culture of the area. I don't know. That's just my take on it. Tom, what do you think about it?
Okay, so I will add a little bit more context. And to be honest with you, I looked at this when the bill was actually passed in Texas and kind of had a general idea or understanding. So this is a relatively recent process, where there was a law passed by the legislature there in Texas that requires the schools to display them. My understanding is it's a plaque or a sign on the wall or something like that. It's not a ritual that they're reciting them every day or whatever. But I'm going to look at this a little bit differently, but I'm probably more inclined with Chase's opinion than I am Ryan's opinion. But let me kind of frame it or contextual frame it around my quote unquote world view. You know, I hold a biblical worldview. My moral compass is based on biblical principles. It has been for years and continues to be. So I look at what the Ten Commandments say. I'm going to butcher if I went and told you every single one of them, because I probably can't do that. But thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not commit adultery. All of these rules or guidelines are really just good moral things to live by. Okay? I mean, they're good principles for anyone to use as a guideline for their life, for their everyday living. That's kind of the way I look at it. I look at it not as much as a religious text as that these are biblical principles, but they are. But I look at it from it's just a good general guideline to live by. I think we struggle with that in some of our communities and some of our school systems. What are we teaching our kids? What are we using as a basis of morality? Everything goes. You know, there's 15 million genders. Everybody has their own path that they're following or whatever the case may be. I think we're a mess when it comes to some of that stuff. But in my opinion, if you take the Ten Commandments, and that's just a good moral compass to follow, a guideline. And I don't think you can go wrong if you kind of keep those Ten Commandments or try your best to keep them. None of us are perfect. As a Christian, we all fall short of the glory of God. And that's why we believe in Christ for salvation, but also that moral compass or that biblical worldview, depending on what your thoughts are. So I look at it with those eyes, but I also look at it from the perspective of it's a good moral set of guidelines to follow to give a foundation for young people that they can build upon.
So let me ask you a question when it comes to this, and then Chase also wants to add something as well.
Sure.
So what if, and this is just me, you know, like kind of like running through the middleman in this situation, what if the commandments were kept, but they were just renamed and retextualized to just modern English and maybe even like jumbled around in different words? For example, make like number one, like number seven or something like that, still a lifeline. And I'm not saying to do it. Okay. Do not think that I'm out here saying remove the Ten Commandments or remove everything biblically and just make it a standardized. But for Texas, is a way not around this just to take the words of Ten Commandments out and just name it like 10 goals?
I mean, there's also the historical piece there. This is a historical text. Nobody can tell you that the Bible is not a historical text. Even folks that don't believe in Christianity will tell you the Bible is a historical text. It outlines history. Changing that, I think, from that perspective is kind of cancel culture. They're trying to cancel that historical context of the Ten Commandments. I mean, even if you're not looking at it from a spiritual piece, the historical piece, would you go take one of the other historical documents or a historical book or Pride and Prejudice or whatever, you know, one of these historical texts out there, would you take those, start rearranging the paragraphs and the sentences and the chapters and verses and all of that kind of stuff? No. But that's my thought. I mean, there's a lot to say on either side of this, but I just kind of wanted to bring it up. Chase, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, so I was just kind of thinking about this over here. I think you could almost frame two different arguments here. You could frame there is the argument that is the law of the United States, and then you could talk about, well, the way that I feel that Western culture is and the way that it was and the way that it should be, in my own opinion, if that makes sense. So I was thinking from the law standpoint, trying to be as equal and fair as possible. I was just thinking that, well, you know, maybe if the citizens of Texas did not want the Ten Commandments up in every public school, per se. I don't know what the politics were over that. I don't know if it was like they wanted it, they didn't want it, they voted, they didn't vote. I'm not sure how it went. But if lawmakers just decided to do it, and then the citizens kind of just said, you know, we don't want that, actually, as it would turn out, then that is what it is, right? It's the United States, the people of the state decided they wanted them down. So, I mean, that's democracy. But at the same time, like I said, my other argument for that would be, is kind of what I had made originally, just that this is the history of the United States. This is the culture as it was, as I believe it still is. And to just start trying to tear that down and change that to make it into something that I would say much fewer people in this country actually want, then that's just not right as far as what the people want and what our civilization is and was, if that makes sense.
Yep. Valid points. I think everybody had quite a bit of valid points, and it's a great thought. I challenge our listeners to put some thought into that and form your own opinion. You don't have to take our opinion. Form your own opinion. And there's no right or wrong answer as to what the best solution for this is. But at least we have the ability to form our own opinions in this country and can share our own opinions publicly, which is a great thing. Our First Amendment rights, what the Constitution and the Bill of Rights provide us in the amendments. We definitely have some great freedoms here as a country. I'm really thankful for that. But that's all the topics that I have for today. I don't know if anybody else has anything else that they want to add to the episode. Feel free to do so, because I'm going to sit back and just listen and throw in some interjectory as necessary if anybody has any other topics.
Yeah, much like you, you perused, you know, to the darkest depths of the internet, sleuthing with your little sleuthing hat on, and you found that crime that was happening on a cruise ship, kind of related to what you have going on. I actually want to bring up one that I just listened to, still currently listening to in the true crime world. And I got to tell you, man, this one, leaning left, if you're leaning right, if you're centric, I think everyone is going to look at the medical examiner of this case and be like, bro, you were an idiot. So much so that it's someone else, and that person leaned that way too. Okay, so what I'm going to be talking about, and I'm going to try to keep it brief and short. So I'm going to talk about Ellen Greenberg. Okay, for those who didn't know, Ellen Greenberg, she died when she was 27 on January 26, 2011 in her apartment in Philadelphia. Her fiance called 911 after finding her in the kitchen. There was a 10-inch knife lodged in her chest. Police said that the apartment door was locked from the inside and there was no obvious signs of an intruder. Okay, so that is just the overall pitch points. Now, what you got to remember is how this is framed, and in the words of the investigator and what they released on the news, the fiance went downstairs, took a shower, worked out, and came back up, and she was dead. On the 911 call, he found her. He said that he had to break open the door. Okay, it was locked from the inside. He broke open the door and called 911. So this is the crazy part out of all this. Okay, so real quick, neither of you guys have any thoughts on this case. You guys are probably hearing this case for the first time. In your opinion, with this knife lodged inside of her, do you think it's murder or suicide?
Murder.
Yeah, I mean,
people don't stab themselves with knives.
Yeah, that doesn't.
People cut themselves. They cut themselves and they bleed out from cutting an artery. They don't actually stab themselves with knives. I mean, from what I know, and I'm not a law enforcement officer or anything like that, but just from my personal opinion, wow, I'm watching a drone land right next door here. That's pretty cool. A little small, looks like a DJI-sized drone. Sorry, I got squirreled there. Go ahead.
I agree. I don't think someone goes out that way. I mean, just from the simple couple minutes we just heard there, we got a door broken down, we've got a knife lodged. I mean, what does that sound like?
Okay, so now it gets even crazier, okay? So back when this suicide murder investigation started, the medical examiner found that she committed suicide, okay? They then released the ME's report. She was stabbed 23 times and had over 31 bruises on her body. They still ruled it a suicide. Fast forward to 2025. By the way, the medical examiner who just ruled this is now out of Philadelphia's medical examiner department. He then reverses his decision and says that it was murder. New examiner comes in and rules a suicide. That is absolutely insane that the two people in the world that would assume something like this was a suicide just both happened to be in Philadelphia. Because I don't know about you, but I don't think somebody can stab themselves 21 times. And by the way, 10 of those stab wounds were on her back, the back of her neck. That is absolute insanity. And that was kind of like my random true crime tidbit for the day. I said that because my brother, has started falling into the world of true crime. And, you know, growing up, he watched Criminal Minds and NCIS and stuff like that with her grandma, but he started to watch Mindhunter, and now he's watching the Monster series on Netflix. So he started talking about true crime, and that just gets my ears perked, because like I said in this last episode, I listen to True Crime Garage. I am true crime a lot, and we probably won't bring this up on the podcast as much because we don't want to get that explicit logo. We would still want to stay family friendly. You know, sometimes we may bring up a really interesting case that we find, or Chase may have thoughts. You know, for example, one of the topics he brought up yesterday, he kind of wanted to bring up, is actually pretty cool, I think. So Chase, if you want to bring it up.
I mean, I was just talking about I just finished the Mindhunter show. Yeah, I had never really been into learning about that kind of stuff. So it was interesting to see and then kind of, you know, go down the rabbit trail here. I don't think I'm going to be into it as much as he is, but I kind of got bit there and I'm kind of leaning into it. I thought Mindhunter was really interesting, man. I mean, I think they did a really good job on the show. I don't know what the realism of it is. I don't know if it's a lot of fiction. My understanding of it is that there's some history, there's some fiction involved, and I just think they did a really good job on the show. I don't think they're done yet. I'm looking forward to see what they've got coming out next. And I did watch, I think everyone remembers when the series about Jeffrey Dahmer released on Netflix. I did watch that, and it was hard to watch. But kind of like the mark for a good show, as far as that goes, just thinking about something that's actually hard to watch, but it is about something so dark that it seems like it almost should be. But one question we were talking about is if you think, well, you don't hear much about that these days. You know, do we think it's still happening? Do you think there's still people that are capable of doing these things modern day? And I was just asking Ron, and I think he had somewhat of an answer for it.
So first off, you know, somebody else who is on this podcast, I want to get his opinion real quick. You've thrown us on the spot once, so I'm going to throw you on there twice. So now that we went on through that, what's your opinion, Tom? Do you think there's still serial killers out there?
Absolutely. I probably can't form a real logical explanation as to why I feel that way, but I believe so. And I think it's probably more of them today. Because I think, okay, so I guess I am forming an opinion and kind of coming up with some rationale behind my opinion. So I think access to the historical information about things that have occurred in the past, you're going to have some copycat folks that are going to take advantage of some of that documentation and information out there. People, you know, back in the 80s and even earlier than that, did not really have access to the information that they have today. So having that access, very likely to see copycat folks. Second would be overall just more information, more access to information, the 24-hour news cycle. We're going to hear about this stuff probably a lot more, but there's so much news. There's so much information that some of these things still to this day slip through the cracks and don't really make the national news cycle because there's just so much. I think there's still serial killers out there. I think if anything, there may be more than they were back in the day. That is my quick wit response to that question.
One thing I did want to bring up, and this is coming from the guy who's constantly around the president. So I'm constantly learning about profiling, stuff like that, because it's interesting to me. It really is. So the FBI has guessed, and this is just a guess, and they use this word active loosely, okay? So the FBI guesses there's anywhere from 25 to 50 active serial killers just in the United States. It doesn't necessarily mean currently in the works. This means unsolved serial killers or undetected serial killers. And then you got the ones that they know about and actively investigating. But some estimates and other research crime science sources suggest there could be many more, you know, who have never been caught or identified. And the important thing that I want to bring up, and you'll learn this the more and more research you do within the realm of serial killing, is that the 70s and 80s was the highlight for it. This was when the FBI and police jurisdictions were not communicating within other departments. They wanted to catch the bad guy. So guys like John Wayne Gacy could hop over state lines, county lines, and kill as many people as he wanted to, and the crimes not be connected. Nowadays, you've got digital fingerprints, which is your phone. You know, people actively are on their phones. You have DNA, which was not back then, and the police have gotten smarter. But with that, you also have the issues like Dennis Rader or Rex Heuermann, the Long Island serial killer, who have researched and gotten smarter over time. What a lot of people assume, and it's crazy to me to assume, they just assume one side gets smarter and the other side doesn't. That's what I can't wrap my head around. I think if one side's getting smarter, the other side is too. And that's kind of like where I'm going to leave it. You know, maybe our audience has a little decision. Maybe they have some kind of comments or anything they want to put in. We are going close, about 9 minutes away from the top of the hour. So, of course, you know, while we're coming up on this, we really want to wish Tom the safest of travels while he's gone. And we're going to be here living our normal lives, hopefully serial killer free, knock on wood, no accidents here. But this has just been a very interesting and different kind of podcast. Tom's traveling and work has been so busy in my brother's life and in my life that we just have not had the time to really dive into topics as much as we wanted to. So some of these topics that we went into, we went through really quickly, but we brought up more and more and more. So we're, you know, kind of ending and wrapping up this podcast. Anything you guys want to say before we head out here?
Yeah, so I will kind of close up then at this point. I will be out to sea next week, so I won't be a part of the podcast, but the boys will be continuing their show, and we'll see how that goes. I'm kind of excited to hear the episode and how that kind of takes shape. But our goal is, regardless of what we're doing, to try our very best to release an episode every single week. And so that's kind of what we're going to try our best to do.
Warning: the views, opinions, and statements expressed in this podcast are for the entertainment purposes only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, their affiliates, or any other organization they may be associated with. The hosts represent themselves and only themselves. Any information presented should not be considered professional advice. Listeners are encouraged to form their own opinion and seek independent verification where appropriate.